The Midwest is overrun by superhuman vampires. This hour, navigating the chaos of a man-made apocalypse with novelist Justin Cronin. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. In the first half hour, we'll listen back to a conversation I had with New York Times best-selling author and Writers Workshop graduate Justin Cronin from 2012. He'll take us to the post-apocalyptic world he's created in his highly acclaimed vampire trilogy. Then in the second half hour, what do Halloween costumes say about our society? We'll listen back to a conversation I had with Annette Lynch, director of the Center for Violence Prevention at the University of Northern Iowa, and Peggy Ornstein, author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter. That's all coming up after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we're listening back to a conversation from 2012 when I spoke with Justin Cronin, author of the dystopian fiction trilogy, The Passage. And in this interview, we focus on the second book of the series called The Twelve. Cronin is currently working on the third book, The City of Mirrors, that's due out in 2015. A government plan to infect a dozen death row inmates with a virus and turn them into a force of uber soldiers has gone horribly wrong. The 12 escape, they infect all in their path, and the result is a coast-to-coast wasteland teeming with undead predators called virals. Now, in book two of the trilogy, it's called The 12, Cronin picks up the story, interweaving characters from year zero. That's when the infection burst out. It also flashes forward in this latest of the trilogy to 79 and 97 years beyond year zero, when we see bands of survivors search for fuel, food, and protection. Joining us now, New York Times best-selling author and Iowa Writers Workshop graduate Justin Cronin in our studio in Iowa City. Hi, Justin. Welcome back.
Thanks. Always a pleasure to be in my beloved Iowa City.
I'd like to have you start off by reading from this latest in the trilogy. I hope it's not jumping ahead too far to get to a section where we are in year zero, and we are actually in Iowa. It makes it especially scary.
Iowa does not get enough airtime in apocalyptic narrative. I really felt like, you know, and I knew it well enough. You know, it was a place I've lived. So I destroy it with love.
Okay, let's hear a part of that where you do that. This particular section, do you need to set it up before we?
Just a little. This is a description of an event, cataclysmic. History-changing event, although the participants don't fully understand that, that occurs in an invented town, actually, in Iowa. I in general, in this novel, I want to work with real places, but I couldn't actually find the perfect place in Iowa. So it's an amalgamation, actually, of several places, and I'll just tell you right now, it's Iowa City and Fort Dodge.
Okay,
sort of staple them together, because the Iowa City, I remember, was small enough, but of course now it's, you know, it's very cosmopolitan. You know, it's metro Iowa City. So, and this is an event that involves a difficult decision by the U.S. military to bomb a site that contains a great many refugees who are trapped in their effort to at least stall the spread of the infection.
Because and also we have waves of virals coming at this
point.
Right,
exactly.
That's the reason for the bombing.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah, I mean, they're not bombing human beings because they're human beings. They're bombing human beings because they are, in fact, luring the infected toward them. And the feeling is that these people have no hope anyway. So they're being used essentially as bait.
Justin Cronin reading from The 12.
The aerial operations over western and central Iowa on the night of June 9th were not without risks. Chief among them was that the pilots would fail to carry out their orders, and in fact, some did not. Seven flight crews refused to deploy their payloads over civilian targets, while three more claimed to have suffered mechanical malfunctions that prevented them from doing so, an aerial operation failure rate of 6%. Of these 10 flight crews, three were court-martialed, five were reprimanded and returned to duty, and two dropped to the deck and were never seen again. In the coming weeks, as the mission of Joint Task Force Scorch expanded to include centers of population throughout the nation's middle section and the Intermountain West, members of the task force would recall this statistic with something like nostalgia, the good old days. By the 1st of August, so many aviators were either sitting in the stockade as prisoners of conscience or had vanished with their aircraft into the skies above the dying continent that it became increasingly difficult to mount a coherent aerial offensive, casting the very mission of JTF Scorch into doubt. These difficulties were compounded by secessionist movements in California and Texas, both of which proceeded to declare themselves sovereign and appropriate all federal military resources within their borders, effectively daring Washington to stop them by force, a remarkably shrewd gambit, both militarily and politically, as by this time the situation was in pure freefall. Much bluster ensued on both sides, culminating in the Battle of Wichita Falls and the Battle of Fresno, in which vast numbers of American military, both on the ground and in the air, threw in the towel, laid down their arms, and asked for sanctuary. Thus, by mid-October of the year that came to be known by subsequent generations as Year Zero, the nation known as the United States could be said to exist no more. But in the early morning hours of June 9th, beneath a moonless Iowa sky, JTF Scorch was still online, enjoying the full or nearly full cooperation of its assets. In confirmation of the task force projections, great masses of infected persons had collected in four distinct hotspots across the state: Mason City, Des Moines, Marshalltown, and the FEMA Refugee Center in Fort Powell. By 0200, the first three had been dispensed with. Fort Powell was the final prize. A combination of A-10 Warthogs and F-18 fighter bombers began the assault. Concurrently, a C-130 transport was inbound from MacDill. Within its bay lay an explosive device called a GBU-43B Massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb, or MOAB, containing 18,700 pounds of H-6 explosive. The MOAB was the largest non-nuclear bomb in the United States military arsenal, capable of producing an impact crater 500 feet in diameter and a blast wave sufficient to level an area the size of 9 city blocks. Its fires would burn for days.
Justin Cronin reading from his latest in his Vampire Apocalypse trilogy. It's called The 12, and Justin joins us in the studio here for this first half hour. It's especially unsettling. As a kid growing up, of course, apocalypses happened in urban centers, not in rural centers. It's very unsettling for me as a Midwesterner, as an Iowan, to have Mason City and Marshalltown and all these places destroyed. But this is a book, as you indicate even on the cover, that this takes place in the heart of the United States.
Yeah, the first book was a book that took place in deserts and forests. And this is a book of fields. It's a book of the open spaces of the center of the country. Principally, you know, the two major settings are Texas and Iowa.
In that reading, we get a sense of what happens when a cataclysm of this magnitude happens. I wonder how you, as a novelist, creating your mind before putting it to text, what it must be like, or would it be like, for Iowa, the Midwest, the U.S. to be destroyed. However can you imagine that? How people react, how governments react, organizations react.
Well, some of it actually goes back to the fact that I am a Cold War baby, and I grew up very, you know, quite convinced actually that I would be incinerated with 20 minutes notice, just like everybody else. So, I've been thinking about this for a long time, and you know, at the height of the Cold War, my dreams were full of it, and I read lots of novels of the apocalypse. I mean, odd expression, but golden age for apocalyptic fiction, because in 1945 we stumbled on the realization that in fact the apocalypse, you know, was very likely to be something we did to ourselves, you know. And so I read a lot of those books. The things I had to think about in writing this book, of course, I had to look for sort of more contemporary analogs. In the first book, there's a newspaper that is found in Year Zero by Wolgast, who is an FBI agent who's hiding up in the mountains. He comes down the mountain to find out what's going on in the world, and he sees a newspaper, and it reports the fall of Chicago. It's a day in the war, and in order to capture the feeling and rhetoric of this, I went and looked at the newspaper, the New York Times, from 9/12, the day after 9/11, to see how you would report on a story of such chaotic catastrophe with so many different elements, and you don't know what's important yet, and there are all these competing things. And so I went and I read that, and it really sort of helped me sort of mentally, you know, kind of get into the space where I could watch and then report on myself a catastrophe of this magnitude.
one of the themes in this book, something that really jumps out, is the very many strong women characters you have in here. Lila, Alicia, Laura Devere, that's a new character, mm-hmm. I believe, not in the passage. And, of course, our supernatural heroine, Amy, who was born on, I believe, page 2 of the passage, mm-hmm. outside of Cedar Falls.
Yes, she's an Iowan. Yes, that's true. Iowa is home to her. That's quite right.
Why did you put so many strong females in this book? We have to mention, this is an inspiration. This book, this trilogy, was an inspiration from your daughter.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the whole thing began with the kind of chemistry I had, you know, and still have, you know, but with at the time, my 8-year-old daughter. She's 16 now, so she's, you know, and 16 is not what 16 used to be, right? But 8 was what 8 is. And, you know, we originally kind of came up with the idea for the book together and worked on an outline. And so, of course, it would be a book about, you know, with a little girl at its heart. But when I was thinking about the whole trilogy, I realized I really wanted to write about women and female strength. I think it's, first of all, it's part of our job as writers to write about people who are different from us. You know, you get your one autobiographical novel about, you know, a white guy in the suburbs, in my case. And then you got to reach out to other types of characters. And I love doing that. And I've always liked writing about women. And most of our creation myths, most of our very powerful myths in Judeo-Western culture are basically very male-oriented. And as I was undertaking this story, I realized that I was most attracted to the female characters as sources of strength. And I wanted to sort of embody in each of several characters a different form of female strength that I've observed. And, you know, in Alicia, for instance, you have just raw physical strength. And, you know, for men who think they're stronger than women, I would say just go watch one have a baby, okay? And you'll stop thinking that right away. In Amy, you have kind of spiritual, intuitive strength. In another character whose name I cannot use because it would be a bit of a spoiler on the novel, you have phenomenal maternal strength. And then in this new character, Lore, you have sensual strength, the power of sex. I keep saying this book is actually an apocalyptic Western feminist novel where the men are really just the baggage handlers.
You were born and raised in New England, right?
Correct, yeah. Uh-huh.
How did it come to pass that you didn't put a little girl from Iowa at the heart of this vampire apocalypse?
Well, sort of symbolically, I wanted this girl to come from the heart of everything. Right. You know, and I lived in Iowa for 4 years. I loved living here. I really, really did. It broke my heart to move away. In fact, I moved back briefly during a period where I kind of had nowhere else to go. I loved living here. And it just made a huge impression on me. And I like to use the places that are meaningful and that I know well in my fiction.
I've always remarked to myself that Iowa is used quite a bit in literature, in film. Much more than other Midwestern states. I've never done a poll on this, but mm-hmm, yeah. Perhaps you would agree. I wonder, with my earlier question too, I wonder if Iowa stands for something more than a geographical place on a map.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, there's a little bit of Iowa in everything I write, and I don't even intend to do this, but even in my second novel, there's a guy who hitchhikes a ride on a truck and he doesn't know where he's going, and the guy's going to Iowa, and he says, "What's in Iowa?" And the guy says, "Three vowels."
four letters, three vowels.
Three vowels. But, you know, Iowa has a symbolic value. It really is, you know, for the coasts, for the sophisticates of our coasts, it represents a kind of pure agrarian place, true flyover country, whereas it also seems to represent kind of the heart of things. I think the importance of Iowa to the political process really is you know, elevates its status in the imagination to a place of a kind of where, you know, a purely American place where things will be decided. And as powerful politically because of its position as, you know, New York, California, the places where it seems that most of our culture is generated from.
Right. Later in the book, we find that, and I hope this isn't any kind of spoiler in the book, we find that Iowa is a homeland,
mm-hmm.
100 years in the future after year zero.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say any more because I don't want to spoil it. Yeah. If you're going to spoil it, you do it. You do the spoiling. What can you tell us about Iowa's as a homeland that you've created mm-hmm. in this book?
Well, the book centers on sort of two human communities, one in Texas, where I live now, and one here in Iowa, a place I know well. It's a sort of yin-yang situation. The community in Texas is one of that functions essentially as a kind of democracy with a strong military flavor. The community in Iowa is a very dark place, I confess. And one of the things I'll say is that the homeland is located in a city that I actually had to cobble together out of several Iowa cities. I like to work with real places, but I couldn't get one city to fully cooperate. So it's a kind of combination of Iowa City and Fort Dodge. And it's it runs essentially like a police state. I mean, one of the novels that's sitting on my shoulders in the background of this book when I was writing it was 1984, which was actually a very important book for me, which I read later than most people do. I read it in college, my senior year in college, and actually wrote my senior thesis on the novel. So it, you know, it functions as you know, sort of the dark side of humanity in a world like this, an unregulated place where people, you know, can form their own societies. And this is sort of an example of the worst of human impulse.
Just a few minutes left. I wonder, broadly speaking, what do you feel is the appeal of experiencing an apocalypse in the pages of a novel? What is the kick that the reader gets?
The reader gets to be a survivor. Because the fact that you are reading it and witnessing these events means that you're not one of the people who died, right? Right. It's very complimentary and reassuring that you are one of the hardy and lucky souls who gets to try to rebuild the world. Because ultimately, all of these novels, unless they're completely nihilistic and grim, and there are a few of these, but most of them, nearly all of them, are not about the end of the world, but really what's, you know, sort of savable about us.
You could have been referring to The Road, perhaps.
Right, exactly, right? I mean, it's a terrible, bleak book, with it, but at its heart, there is this, you know, touching and resilient human relationship. On the other side of the spectrum, you have a book I read that had a profound effect on me and many people, too. It actually sort of changed the public perception of nuclear war, On the Beach, written in the early 60s, published serially in the UK as The Last Days on Earth, and indeed, everything ends at the end of that book.
Your vampire apocalypse trilogy comes at a time when we do a lot of imagining zombie apocalypses in this country. The Walking Dead, one of the most popular series on cable at the moment. I wonder if you've thought about what your apocalypse has in common with zombies or how it's different.
Well, I mean, the first thing I'd like to say is that if you post something on Facebook that mentions The Walking Dead in the ads on the right, immediately you get ads for guns.
Really? Yeah. Survival mode.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they assume that you're interested in weaponing up. I mean, there's a way in which this, you know, people actually think, I have to remind them, you know, it's like, this isn't real, people. Zombies do not exist. No, I was, you know, I was as influenced by zombie narration, you know, zombie films, principally when I wrote this book, as by vampires. The vampire story has got lots of good little details. The zombie story has got the idea of the horde. Right. You know, busting down your door.
But you have hordes of virals.
Right. Yeah. They're zombie-like in that regard.
You have to be with me on this. I would much rather face a zombie than a viral.
But zombies are slow. And they're already dead. I mean, that's
they've only got a very small fraction of their brain working, right?
Exactly. And, it makes them sort of easy targets. I mean, most zombie books and movies and now The Walking Dead, eventually there's a scene where it's like, you know, people just start picking them off, right? I mean, it degenerates eventually into a kind of slapstick as people realize that killing them is not only a good idea, it's actually a little bit pleasurable.
And you chose here with your apocalypse, your virals, they're much more lethal. Why did you do that?
To ratchet it up, you know, to create a deeper and more profound urgency. And because logistically, it made sense. I wanted to go into a distant future. I wanted to go 100 years in the future, right? And the origin of the virus that creates this race of, you know, monsters is thought to be the virus that is the source of the vampire legend, including the legend of immortality. They would last a really, really long time. That's why scientists go looking for this virus in the first place, thinking that it will radically increase human lifespan. Of course, they get the whole package, which is the problem.
Mm-hmm. Back to our talking about an apocalypse in more broader terms. I know someone, I have a friend whose family has a plan in case of some sort of cataclysm. Members of this family all plan to meet at some secret location,
exactly.
Some valley, a cave or something in the Midwest. I wonder, do you have any sort of plan like that for your family?
I confess I don't. I actually think about it, though. I'm just kind of paranoid enough to think about this? I mean, I've gotten so far as making sure I'm prepared for a hurricane. I live in Houston, and we've, you know, we've been through a couple. Ike was, you know, hit us a few years ago. True zombie readiness is not something that I've ratcheted up to, but when my daughter took riflery at camp last year, I said, that's good. Now you can take the back windows.
Well, zombies aside, isn't it also when we talked about the allure of reading about an apocalypse, you said you're the survivor. You get to be the survivor.
Right.
But in, for instance, with a zombie, or perhaps with your book too, we have something introduced that seems so not reality.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make it somehow safer to consume?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the books that I read about, you know, global nuclear annihilation seemed frighteningly intimate. However, one of the things I think that draws people into the passage and now the 12 is the fact that we are very worried about viral pandemic, and we should be. We have created a world that is perfect for the transmission and the rapid movement of a highly lethal virus. The Spanish flu in 1918 killed at least 50 million people worldwide, and that was a world with ships, not planes.
Let's talk before we have to go quickly about the filming of this. Any update on that? Last time you told us, very early on, Ridley Scott bought the rights to this. Any updates on that?
Yeah, I mean, I go out and talk to those people every once in a while. My connection to it is fairly attenuated. People say, what's your role? And I always say, I write the novels that the movies will be based on, you know, and that seems like more than enough work.
And it's out of your hands.
Yeah, it's out of my hands. And making a movie is difficult and challenging. You got to get a lot of people together in the room, and you got to get tax breaks in New Zealand, you know, to film it. And you got to have the whole thing catered. I just put on my bathrobe and go up to my office. It's wonderfully simple. I think that, you know, they were kind of waiting for the second book because they need to know how the story continues, because the whole thing is, you know, most meaningful to them, as it is to readers of the books, as a three-film franchise.
So there's no screenplay, no action figures yet?
No action figures yet. There is a screenplay that's been kicking around. The concern about it is that it has to do all – the real problem is they have to condense a lot. I mean, you're trying to fit, you know, a 700-page novel as the first one is and a 580-page novel as the second one is, each of them into 2.5 hours of film. That's pretty tough.
I actually was appreciative of your cast of characters. What do you call it at the end of the book?
The dramatis, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Very helpful for the reader, because in each era, you do have a number of characters to keep track of.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, these are very well-populated novels. And it was kind of part of the fun of the whole thing for me. I loved writing a dramatis. I really felt like when I wrote that and put it in the back, I was saying, you know, I've written a big book, you know, and part of the, you know, part of my ambition is to think large, you know, with this.
One of those characters, an Iowa National Guard soldier named?
Porcecki. Major Porcecki. Yeah.
Okay, you'll have to find out about Major Porcecki in Justin Cronin's latest novel. It's called The 12. You working on the third?
Yes, I am. Yes,
I am. Do we have a name for that yet?
The City of Mirrors.
The City of Mirrors.
So that one is an urban landscape. We went from fields, you know, forests and mountains to the fields to finally the city.
New York Times bestselling author and Iowa Writers Workshop graduate Justin Cronin. Coming up in the second half hour after a short break, what do Halloween costumes say about our society? Also, the question of when is a costume too sexy for a young person? Our guests, Annette Lynch, director of the University of Northern Iowa's Center for Violence Prevention, and Peggy Orenstein, author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter. That's when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program.
Well, are you dressing up this year for some kind of Halloween celebration, or are you just in the, I guess, advisory role, advising your kids, telling your kids, asking your kids what they want to dress up as? Let's talk about what do Halloween costumes say about our society, and when is a costume, for instance, too sexy, too violent? Joining us to talk about Halloween costumes, Annette Lynch, director of the Center for Violence Prevention at the University of Northern Iowa, also a professor at UNI School of Applied Human Science in our Cedar Falls studio. Hello, Professor Lynch.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Good to have you with us, Annette. Also joining us by phone, Peggy Orenstein, author of the New York Times bestsellers Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Girly Girl Culture, and Waiting for Daisy, also a contributing writer for the New York Magazine. Peggy Orenstein, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Annette Lynch, let me turn to you first of all. How would you describe the change in Halloween costume culture in the last few years?
Well, the Halloween culture on college campuses really picked up about 15 years ago. And as a result, marketing of Halloween costumes on college campuses became a major business, creating stores and online services to students. And what happened was a very binary gender marketing system where young women were marketed very sexy costumes, very attractive, kind of hedonic power messages, and young men were marketed similarly very kind of narrow costuming in the area of more action-oriented, more agonic, active power kinds of messages. And that those kind of trends have trended down into the tween market and into progressively even younger girl markets. And so that's, I think, one of the big trends.
Peggy Orenstein, can you tell us a little bit more about the younger set? We had Annette address mostly the college age set. What do you see happening in costume culture for teens and below?
Well, yeah, so I look at younger girls because I have one. I have a 9-year-old. And we just try to stay out of Target for the month of October and avoid it. But you really, the kind of little honey bee costumes, the little superhero skirt costumes, the sort of whole sexy costume genre, it was really interesting to hear about the college students because what happens is that just keeps drifting lower. And now you really are seeing these kind of sexualized, highly sexualized costumes commonly for 4, 5, 6-year-old girls.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us some examples? I hear sort of descriptions, but give me a concrete image of what you might see in a Target, in a Walmart that you think is a bit going a bit too far.
Well, let's say a Monster High costume, which is a popular line of Mattel dolls, for a 4-year-old girl that has a little tiny short skirt, platform boots, a tight top, and a choker.
Mm.
You know, that kind of thing, or little witch costumes that have a lot of times, it's, you know, when you see the package, the child is posed in a very coy way. The skirts are very short. There's a tightness. There's sort of a sassy. Yeah, I would say sassy is sexy with training wheels. So rather than saying like sexy witch, they'll say sassy witch. That's what you would have for a little girl's costume. And there's just, you know, a lot of, I mean, I don't know what happened to throwing a sheet over your head and, you know, cutting a couple holes in it and saying boo. But there's a lot of research, particularly from the American Psychological Association, that when you impose inappropriate sexuality on little girls, it has a long-term cognitive and emotional impact on them, and it makes them vulnerable as they get older to the kinds of things that we worry about with girls, to negative body image, to eating disorders, to depression, to poor sexual choices. So when we sexualize girls really young and start becoming sort of inured to that, it really has an impact.
Annette Lynch, you've researched costume, dress, and the impacts on college students and children's behaviors. What do you have to add to that?
Well, you see fairly severe drops in self-esteem for girls as they enter fifth and sixth grade and go into junior high. And a lot of that has to do with a narrowing of how they're measuring themselves and how they're measuring other girls in their classes. And so instead of thinking about whether or not you can sink the basketball, you're only looking at whether or not you're attracting attention, and particularly sexual attention. And so that sort of be sexy, that's the way to get power message is very damaging as they enter junior high age. And that's precisely when the marketing machine really kicks in for selling these costumes to girls. I did a content analysis of on-site, on online and catalogs, and 62% of the costumes marketed to age 3, 4, 7, 8 are sexy. By the time you get into the tween market, which is that 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade market, 96% of the costumes that are being sold to girls have that sexy girl message, and it's that sort of message that if you look like this, you've got power. And that's a very narrow definition of power, and really does limit these girls in terms of how they feel about themselves and how they interact with their peer groups.
I want to get back to the sexiness of Halloween costumes in just a moment, but this other aspect here, I think, is brought out in this collection of voices. Iowa Public Radio student producer Caitlin Fry visited the Coral Ridge Mall in Coralville to ask girls what their Halloween costume choices were when they were younger and what influenced their decisions. Let's listen.
Princesses, usually. I was like Snow White. I was Belle. I was like all the little Disney princesses.
A witch, a princess, Disney princess, and Trinity from The Matrix.
I was Dalmatians. I was Cinderella one year.
I went from anything from a horse to a ballerina to a football player.
Usually, if I got an idea in my head, it probably was something I'd seen on TV. And usually it was like a Halloween costume, like, ad, because I'd be like, oh, I have to have that.
It was mostly like Disney movies. So whatever movie I was watching that year was the costume I'd pick. Yeah, but mostly it was movies that inspired my costumes as a child.
So in those voices just collected a few days ago, we hear that, and I understand your concerns about Halloween costumes for young women being girls, being too sexy, but here we see it's commercial-driven, isn't it? I mean, by and large, kids today, as in past years, are dressing up according to what they see on TV and on the silver screen. Peggy Orenstein.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I think that's increasingly true as we live in a media-saturated culture. But then what they've been increasingly presented with is a sexualized image of what they're seeing on screen. So, you know, if you go in the store and you look at the witch costume and you look at the fairy costume and you look at the vampire costume, it may be that that's what a girl would tell you she dressed up as. But when you look at what the costume looks like, you look at what the packaging looks like, it's become a much more sexualized version of what we think of as those costumes as adults, what they were like when we were little kids.
Is there any change in how the type of costumes that we have for kids? Annette Lynch, boys tending to have costumes with professions that project power, girls, cute objects of desire. Has that changed over in the years?
I think it's that what's happened is a more binary and a more narrow system, partly because I think almost all costumes are, or at least most costumes are now purchased. And so there's not quite as much, as Peggy said, pulling the sheet over your head or inventing costumes. I think it's when you let young people, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th graders, invent a costume, which I've done in Halloween parties for kids, they actually go out of those binary systems. Their own creativity will lead them in directions where they self-define instead of being defined by the marketing machine. But I think that as if you sort of look at parents and what can parents do or what can caring people do, I think that offering venues where you allow your child to really invent themselves instead of being invented by someone that's selling them a costume. I think Halloween's about fantasy, and so it should be a place where you can define your going in a real dramatic and kind of almost a aspirational way.
River to River listeners, we have a few minutes to hear your thoughts on Halloween costumes. What are guidelines there? What you've experienced in your home, in your family? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email if you have a question or a comment. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. So one of the observations made is that when we go in and look for girls versus boys, that no matter what the costume, with a couple of exceptions, hundreds of costumes, most retailers only sell the skirted Halloween costumes for young girls. Spider Girl with a skirt. Is that a problem? Do you see that as a problem, Peggy?
You know, I remember that just reminded me of my daughter when she was 4 or 5. She was sort of into superheroes, and she looked at me one day and said, "Girls superheroes show their belly buttons. I don't know why." And, you know, I thought, you know, it's hard to talk to girls about why their costumes need to have short skirts, why it makes it harder for them. You know, I would say things to her like, well, how do you think the Supergirl with the skirt, does that get in her way? When, you know, how do you fight with that on? How do you do what the superhero needs to do? And I just wanted to go back a second and say, you know, I'm all for making the costume, too. I am the worst seamstress in the world. I can't sew a lick. But Halloween comes around, and, you know, my daughter and I just work to use her imagination to make a costume and break her out of those roles. And that, I think, is really the number one way. Just don't buy it, you know. Just don't buy into it and just don't buy it. And you can work with your daughter to make a great and weird costume or have a scary costume contest.
Yeah, but over the last couple of generations, we have now two parents working, and we have less time for those homemade costumes. That's a shame.
Absolutely, and I am a working mom. My husband's a working dad, and you know, we've been little by little, you know, and our costume isn't complicated this year. We kind of took a big piece of velvet and cut a hole in it. But you know, I think it's not only the sexualization, it's the commercialization and the limiting of kids' imaginations. I mean, Nat was right that this is really true. This is a time to let your imagination run wild, and it's sort of sad that we've lost that with our kids.
Let's go to Suzanne in Grinnell before our hour finishes up. Hi, Suzanne. You've been listening. What are your thoughts?
Oh, yeah. I have a son who's 4 years old, and between my era and his, it's changed enormously in terms of the genderization. Everything is pink for girls and camouflage for boys, and so it's this background. When I was a kid, I could have been, say, Batman or Robin, and that would have been okay. Now everything is, you know, Batman or Robin seems to be the terrain exclusively of a boy, and so, and vice versa, he can't be something that would have been more neutral. So I guess I see it as who has rights to those what I consider neutral categories of superheroes or anything else. I mean, I'm making a costume. My son's going to be an excavator, but
an excavator. It'll be one of the few walking door to door in your town, I think.
That's what he wants to be. So I agree. Well, it's about dreaming, and that's
good
what
for
wants
him.
To dream into.
Well, operating that big machinery is fun. I fantasized about that as a child as well. Suzanne, thank you for your input from Grinnell.
Okay.
Let's go to Chris quickly in Altoona. Hi, Chris.
Hey, I was calling about the comment about the girls and stuff and everything, how people, like, just let their children buy whatever costume that they want.
Yep.
I think parents should, like, go with their children to buy their costume just so they approve of it, because, like, if they don't go with them, they're going to have their friends go, and their friends are going to influence their opinion, like on how sexy or how cute it is.
Chris, do you have firsthand experience? Are you a parent?
I have a daughter on the way, but I do have a little sister that is very influential on my opinion.
Okay, very good. So you'll be there when that daughter comes along as she grows up to pick out, or perhaps, better yet, make a Halloween costume, Chris.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Chris, thanks for calling from Altoona. I wanted to ask you, Peggy and Annette. Well, Annette, first of all, before we do this, quickly, you are director of the Center for Violence Prevention. We've talked a lot about sexiness, but there are a lot of violent costumes out there for Halloween. What gives you pause when we talk probably about boys' costumes and violence?
In fact, there was just another shooting recently, domestic violence shooting outside of Milwaukee that I just read about and posted on the our Facebook page for the center. It's just repeatedly we're inundated with gun violence, and when the kids come to the door, a lot of the boys are either carrying guns or wearing costumes that are related to violence, and so I think, to kind of go back again to having these kids think outside the box, I think what they're going to be marketed as a young boy is a violent costume. And I think that in order to kind of steer them and open up possibilities for them, having them work on their own costumes is helpful.
What do you do if your child wants a certain kind of costume, period, and won't budge no matter what argument is given? Annette Lynch.
I think that you can have, in fact, one of the things that I'm working on are scenario-based trainings for 5th and 6th grade and junior high girls, where you really lead these girls through scenarios where they begin to reflect on why they want that costume, what are some more creative costumes that they might have that would reflect aspirational ideas about where they want to go. So I think that as a culture, we need to create some what I think are real world scenario based kind of media education kinds mm-hmm. of projects for young girls so that we don't tell them they can't have a costume. They actually go through the thought process where they decide, hey, wait a minute. You know, I can do a lot of different things. Maybe I want to act out on Halloween right. something that is bigger and broader and more exciting.
What about acting out this? Do either of you know Jenna Marbles?
No.
Okay. Jenna Marbles, I didn't before this morning either. A video blogger, Jenna Marbles, posts videos on YouTube touching on many issues young women face today. Jenna Marbles has over 4.5 million subscribers to her vlog, almost 800,000 video views. Most of her material is comedic, sarcastic. This is a clip you're about to hear where Jenna has her take on sexy Halloween costumes. I'd like you to react to it. Why they're harmless, she says, and why women should not be judged for Halloween costumes, however slutty they may be. Let's listen.
Halloween is the one night a year that you get to be whatever you want to be. And when you see these girls dressed as sexy cops, nurses, animals, I don't know. It's not that they're really such a huge fan of cops and nurses and animals. It's that they just want to be a slut for Halloween because they're probably not sluts in real life.
Wow. What does that say about our society, Peggy Orenstein?
Oh, actually, I do know who she is, and I have heard that. Well, I don't think, I don't think she's talking about little girls.
Right.
When she says girls, she's talking about adult women. And, you know, we can have a whole different
Maybe teenagers. A lot of teenagers watch her vlog, but go ahead.
But, you know, what we've been talking about is the way that defining yourself through appearance, defining yourself through the idea that, you know, you can't be too sexy and you can't be too sexy too young, is a message that's been drifting down to girls who are 3, 4, 5 years old in a way that's really unprecedented in our culture and has an impact. And I would also, you know, what Annette just said about her program I think is fantastic. I also feel as a parent, you know, you can't censor your way out of this stuff. And you have to fight fun with fun. And so when confronted with, you know, with a daughter who is saying, but I want this, but I want this, but I want this, you know, you really have to work not just on this one night a year, but on the rest of the year, on creating alternatives that are really fun and creative and exciting ways to express your joy in being a girl that aren't constantly connected with appearance and hotness.
Annette Lynch, react to that Jenna Marbles clip that you heard.
I think that it's very easy to make light of the fact that young women narrowly define themselves in terms of and sort of try to be as hot as possible in order to get power, that sexy is power.
Right. That's the other argument, that they're not being kept down. They're expressing freedom and putting themselves in a position of power, right?
But that's a very, very that power compared to the power to legislate a change so that we end up having our economy go up instead of go down. That's power. And just being able to attract the attention of someone else is certainly a form of power, but it's not a form of power that has the same kind of impact as egonic power, which is the power to make decisions, the power to move things forward, the power to drive a truck with a hard hat on and build a building. And so men also, you know, there's a certain power that men have that are good looking. Well, you know, if a good looking man walks into the room, he attracts attention, but he doesn't limit himself typically to dressing up like that for Halloween and saying, hey, look at me, you know, I'm really hot tonight. And that's because men are socialized to look at themselves in broader terms. And so we're all sexual beings in some way, and we can all express that part of ourselves, but it's only one element. It's only one part of a human being. And
can
women
I say one other thing about that?
Very quickly, please. Yep.
I think it's really important to distinguish between sexuality and sexualization with girls, and the two are getting really mushed together. And mm-hmm. sexualization is something imposed from outside that is telling them that their role is to be desirable to others, as opposed to sexuality, which is intimate, cultivated from within, and helps you understand your connection to your own desire better. And I think that the conflating of the two in the culture is part of the problem, and that may be where Jenna Marbles is getting kind of confused.
Peggy Orenstein, thank you very much. Author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter and Waiting for Daisy, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Annette Lynch, director of the Center for Violence Prevention at the University of Northern Iowa and professor at UNI School of Applied Human Science. Thanks for coming into our Cedar Falls studio.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And to wind up today's show, we have a little clip from the YouTube video. It's called Things You Can Be on Halloween Besides Naked. It's by two women of the fashion blog Emotive Style. And in the song, they encourage women to dress classy and appropriately, and they share several unique costume ideas. American fashion consultant and television personality Tim Gunn also joins the video with a rap at the end of the song. Let's start this off, Dennis.
So many things that you can be without your melons hanging out or your cheeks. Be the color purple starring Oprah Winfrey. Whoopi Goldberg was in that too. Great movie. Like Rick from Pecos or about Burt's Bees. A phone charger, a blah, a blah. The Blue Man Group, if you have blue dye, you could be the sisters from the first suicide. Showing off your navel.
And that does it for this edition of River to River. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
It's Halloween and there's so many things that you can be this year. Like Big Edie, Little Edie,
ask
Tim Gunn. He's a professional.
I like what you're saying and I see what you're after, but these costumes are lacking in wow factor. We're going for...